Today you lost your life, what would you leave behind? What would the ones around you see? What happened in the dash between your birth and death? What will you do to change your legacy? What will you do to change your legacy?
Hey everyone, this is Steve Donahue with another episode of the Legacy Podcast, helping you build a multi-generational legacy of abundance. Today's episode is number 87, and this is going to be a recording of the message that I preach today at the church in which I pastor, Mount Tabor Baptist Church, on Genesis chapter 3, which is the calling of Moses from the burning bush. And what we talk about in this passage is the revelation of God to Moses as to who he is and his character and what he plans to do with the people of Israel. So it's a great message of understanding the nature of God and how he's revealed himself to us. And so it's a good message there. Hopefully you'll enjoy it and benefit from it as you build your worldview, biblical worldview. But before we do that, I want to take care of a few business items. First of all, make sure that you're continuing to send in to me questions that you might have about building a legacy, whether it be with your family or in the area of farming and gardening, or whether it is in the area of personal liberties and economic freedom. Whatever area it is that we talk about here on the Legacy Podcast that interests you and you have further questions, I encourage you to email me those questions at steve@thelegacypodcast.com. I'll get back with you personally with those questions answered, and then I hope to be able to include those questions in a question-answer format somewhere in the website in the future. So do that for me if you will. And then also, our affiliate focus for today is Envelopes. And Envelopes is a great organization and business online where you can have an online budget software to allocate the various money that you bring in each month to various categories and envelopes, just as you would if you had cash and you put that cash into various envelopes for spending. The Envelopes program allows you to do that all online, so it's a very great way of keeping track of all your budget and making sure that you spend only what you have allocated to do so in the various categories. And I think the first 15 or 30 days or so is free of it, and then after that it's just a minimal charge of like $8 to $10 or something like that a month. And excellent resource for you there. So check out Envelopes. Second is Vision Form. Vision Form is a great online store. Of course, they have a catalog as well, but it's an online store where you can purchase material for building a legacy in your family. And they have resources, audios, as well as DVDs and books, helping you to pass on the faith from one generation to the other, helping to strengthen your family, strengthen your marriage, building a biblical theology around that and around the family, and equipping men and equipping women. And also there's a great assortment of boy and girl toys in there, and just a great resource. So check out Vision Forum. You can check out both of our affiliates as well as all the other ones that I've mentioned in previous podcasts on the center right column of the website. If you punch on that, then you purchase anything through them, of course, I will be able to get a little bit of commission from that sale. So make sure that you continue to go through my website to those sources, and that will help out the show. Appreciate you doing that. Third thing is make sure that you're registered as user of the Legacy Podcast. This enables you to make comments to each of the podcasts. It also enables you to get updates when they happen. So if you want to get an email each time there is a change to the website without having to check back and be notified of that, then register. There's no charge to that, and there's no spamming involved. And so register, you can do that on the right column of the website. And then also I want to, if you like what we do, I would encourage you to become a Legacy Partner. Our Legacy Partner program is the best way of supporting the show. You can support the show at 25 cents an episode, plus you're able to have access to our exclusive members-only website, which are exclusive-only members page, which has some downloadable material on there, an ebook, or some other charts and resources, as well as some discounts to some various vendors, and that's a great resource for you. So, but most importantly, it's able to help out the show, and I appreciate your help in doing that, so consider the Legacy Partner Program. That takes care of the introductory material, so now let's go ahead and turn our attention to Exodus chapter 3 with the revelation of God to Moses in the burning bush.
I don't know how many of you all are very good at starting fires. I'm not one. Although I really like fires, it seems to be a real challenge for me to be able to start fires. I remember a year or so ago, I had a bunch of brush, and I wanted to be able to have a big bonfire. So I, you know, got all my kids to get a big brush pile together, and oh, we're going to have a great time bonfire. I couldn't get the thing started. I put oil on it. I put fire starter on it. I did everything that I could to get that thing started, and I couldn't get it started. And when we went camping a while back with my dad, I tried to start the fire, and no success. My dad had to do it. And it's kind of embarrassing when, you know, you invite friends and everybody to go camping with you, and you can't get the fire started. I really am intrigued by fire, though, as most boys are. They seem to like fire. And I can only imagine what it had been like for Moses when he is out in the wilderness shepherding the sheep of his father, and he sees a bush burning, that he did not start the fire. There was no lightning around. And all of a sudden, this bush starts burning. But what is even more phenomenal than that is that the bush doesn't burn up. It just continues to burn. And so we have one of those great understatements in the scriptures where it says Moses decides to go and see what is so interesting about this bush that burns but does not burn up. And that's kind of where we pick up with chapter 3. But before we do that, let me kind of cover where we are to this point. We left the last message with Moses being saved by Pharaoh's daughter and being able to be raised up in the palace of Egypt. He did that for 40 years. And then after those 40 years, he went out to look at the Hebrew people, and he saw them being abused by some of the Egyptians, and he actually raised up and killed one of the Egyptians and knew that at that point he was in trouble, so he flees into the wilderness. And while he's in the wilderness, he meets Jethro and Jethro's daughters and marries one of Jethro's daughters and becomes a shepherd out in the regions of what is now Saudi Arabia, the Sinai area. And by the way, that prepares him for another time when he will spend time out in that region shepherding people rather than sheep. And so God sends him out to the wilderness for 40 years. So he's about 80 years old now, and he's out shepherding his father's sheep. And that's what we pick up in chapter 3. And what it says here in verse 1, it says, "Now Moses was tending the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian, and he led the flock to the back of the desert and came to Horeb, the mountain of God." Now, when we think of desert, we think of the Sahara Desert, where there's nothing but sand everywhere. Or we think of the Mojave Desert out in California, where there's nothing there. Or in Arizona, where I lived for a little while, where there's, you know, nothing but maybe a few cactus that grow. And that's not what is here. The word desert here means deserted region. It doesn't necessarily mean uninhabitable or no kinds of plants there at all. In fact, he was obviously shepherding some sheep there, and so, or some goats. And so the best way to understand it is, if you've ever been to eastern Texas, that's probably the best way. It's a dry area, but it's not like devoid of any kind of vegetation. And so he's in this region shepherding the flock of his father-in-law Jethro, and it says that he came to Horeb, the mountain of God. Now, Horeb is also another name for Mount Sinai. And, of course, Mount Sinai is the region and the area, the mountain on which later in Exodus, God meets with Moses and gives him the Ten Commandments and the rest of the law. And so that's why it's referred to here as the mountain of God. And then verse 2, it says, "The angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire from the midst of a bush. So he looked, and behold, the bush was burning with fire, but the bush was not consumed." Now, first of all, we have to understand that this was a theophany. Now, that's a big word that theologians use for an appearance or a manifestation of God himself, a theophany. And the idea is that when we read in the scriptures where it says an angel of God appeared to Mary, for example, then that was a messenger of God sent by God to bring a message. But when it says the angel of God, that usually is a reference to God himself, a theophany or a Christophany, meaning a manifestation of Christ prior to his incarnation. And so here we have, and the angel of the Lord appeared to him in the flame of fire from the midst of the bush. So he looked and behold, the bush was burning with fire, but the bush was not consumed. That must have been a very unusual sight, no doubt, to be able to see this bush burning and yet realize that it's not burning up. And as all of us would have done, we would have gone to investigate what the situation is. And so we have the first of the questions that are asked of Moses in this passage when he says, why does the bush not burn? In verse 3, so Moses said, I will now turn aside and see this great sight, why the bush does not burn. And so he approaches the bush, and as he approaches the bush, God begins to reveal himself to Moses. And in the revelation that he has towards Moses, it gives us some great insight into the character and to the nature of God. And so the first thing that he reveals, God reveals himself as unapproachably holy. Unapproachably holy. Look with me in verse 6. It says, so when the Lord saw that he had turned aside to look, God called to him from the midst of the bush, and he said, Moses, Moses. And he said, here I am. Then he said, do not draw near this place. Take your sandals off your feet, for the place where you stand is holy ground. Now there was nothing special about the bush. There was nothing special about the vegetation or the soil underneath the bush or the surrounding region. What made it special was the presence of God in that bush. And so it is in the presence of God that there is holiness. And so he tells Moses, he says, you cannot approach me. I am a holy God. Take your feet, take your sandals off your feet, and do not come near, because I am a holy God, unapproachably holy. He says that you are about to tread upon holy ground. And so what does Moses do? Verse 5, he says, do not draw near, take your feet off, take your sandals off your feet. You're about ready to stand on holy ground. Verse 6, moreover, he said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look upon God. You see, when we as fallen creatures, as we as human beings who realize our own sin and our own unholiness, when we come in contact with the holiness of God, it is only natural for us to want to shield our face. For us to want to hide ourselves in the presence of God. Remember what happened to Adam and Eve when they realized their own sin? What did they do? They hid from God. They understood that they could no longer be in the presence of the holy, unapproachable God because of their sin. And so they hid. So what does Moses do when he realizes he's speaking to the holy God? He says his ground is holy. He says he hides his face in fear of looking upon God. It reminds us of the call that Isaiah had in chapter 6 of Isaiah. It says, in the year King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord sitting on the throne, high and lifted up, and the train of his robe filled the temple. Above it stood seraphim. Each one had six wings. With two he covered his face. With two he covered his feet. Now why would the seraphim cover their face and cover their feet? Because they were in the presence of God. God had created these creatures to demonstrate and to signify the holiness of being in his presence. They had to cover their face so that they would not see God. They had to cover their feet because they were in the presence of God. And then he says, with two wings, they flew. And one cried to the other, holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory. And the posts of the door were shaken by the voice of him who cried out, and the house was filled with smoke. So I said, woe is me, for I am undone. See, that's the response of a fallen creature in the presence of a holy God. Woe is me, for I am undone. Because I am a man of unclean lips, and I dwell in the midst of a people of unclean lips, for my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts. Now, if we were to continue reading now, we would see that what Isaiah was thinking at the point was he was saying, uh-oh, I have seen the holiness of God. When me, a fallen creature, sees the holiness of God, woe is me. I am undone. Same thing Moses was thinking. He was in the presence of God. God says, do not come near this place. You are about to come before me, and I am a holy God. And so Moses says, I'm not going to look. There's no way me, a fallen creature, can look upon God. The word holiness means to be apart, to be separate, to be distinct, to be other than normal. It means someone who is different than common, something opposite than common. A good picture of this is the Holy of Holies. If you remember the description of the temple and how the temple had different sections within the temple, there was the common area, and then there was the holy place where the sacrifices were made, and then there was the most holy place, or the Holy of Holies. It was curtained off, and inside that section was the ark that carried with it the Ten Commandments and the rod that that budded and the piece of man and all this kind of stuff. And that was where once a year the high priest would take the sacrifice and would go in there and would sprinkle the blood upon the ark as a symbol of their sacrifice before God to be able to come into his presence. But they didn't do this lightly. In fact, once a year it was selected by lot that the high priest would go in there. And before the high priest would go in there, they would tie him up with a rope. And they would put a special garments on him so that there was bells at the bottom of his garment. So that when he went in there, if he were to be struck dead in the presence of God, they would realize it because the bells would stop moving and they'd be able to pull him out with the rope. That's an understanding of the holiness of God. There's not one of us who would be able to stand before God and say, I'm here and I deserve to be here. There's not one of us. And yet it's interesting when we talk to people about the gospel, and if you've had any kind of training in evangelism, I got trained with Campus Crusade for Christ to, you know, present the four spiritual laws. First law, of course, is that God loves you and a wonderful plan for your life. Second law is that you're separated from God because of your sin. Usually the way that you enter into the conversation, though, with somebody is you say that if you were to pass away, God forbid, tonight, and you were to stand before God, and he were to ask you, why should he let you into his heaven, what would you say? Do you know what the most common response is? Because I'm basically a good person. That's what most people say. Well, there's two problems with that. One is that it elevates you to near perfection. If you can stand before God and say, I'm basically deserving, then it raises you to a level of holiness that you're not. The second thing is that it demotes God to common. To be able to say that we can stand before God in our own efforts brings God down to our level. And neither one is the case. There's got to be another way. And the good news is there is another way. Bible tells us that we can come boldly to the throne of God to find help in our time of need. How? Because of the grace of God through Christ. That's how we're able to enter in the Holy of Holies. It's through his sacrifice. And so we have hope. Because God is an unapproachable, holy God, he has also made a way for us to be able to enter in. He does that through Christ. Second thing that he reveals here in this passage is God reveals himself as the one who uses man to accomplish his plans. Look with me in verses 8 and 9. It says, so I have come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up from the land to a good and large land, to a land flowing with milk and honey, to a place of the Canaanites and the Hittites and the Amorites and the Perizzites and the Hivites and the Jebusites. Now, therefore, behold, the cry of the children of Israel has come to me, and I also have seen the oppression with which the Egyptians oppressed them. Come now, therefore, I will send you to Pharaoh, that you may bring my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt. Why doesn't God just make things happen like that? Could God have gone directly to Pharaoh, just like he spoke to Moses here in the burning bush? Could God not have just appeared with a hand writing on the wall? We've seen that before, right? Book of Daniel. Why could God not just have appeared to Pharaoh and said, "Look, I am the God of the Hebrews, let him go"? Why didn't he do that? Because God uses man to accomplish his methods. Can you believe that? This holy, unapproachable God uses men. And when I say men, I don't mean just men. I mean men and women, mankind, right? He uses men to be able to accomplish his plans. Isn't that incredible? So verse 10, he says, "I will send you that you may bring my people out of Egypt." You know, God has a sense of humor, I think, in a lot of ways. That he would use fallen man. You know, it'd be a whole lot easier if he just did it himself. How many of you all have had children that you've tried to teach to do chores? Sometimes hard, isn't it? It seems like it'd be a whole lot easier just to do it yourself, isn't it? You're trying to teach your kids how to wash the dishes, and you look at them after they're on the drying rack and you say, "Did you even wash this? I mean, there's still all kinds," and you have to go back and you have to rewash it, right? Because they didn't do a good job. And you think to yourself, it'd just be easier if I do it. And I can only imagine what God is thinking. After he goes and he calls men to do certain tasks and we mess it all up, and he thinks to himself, "I could just do it for you. It'd just be a lot easier. It'd be a lot more efficient if I could just do it myself." But that's not what he does. He uses men to be able to accomplish his methods and his plans. And that's amazing. He does this not just with Moses and the deliverance there, but he does it in other areas as well. You think of evangelism. Listen to what it says in Romans chapter 10, verses 13 through 15. It says, "For whoever calls on the name of the Lord shall be saved. How then shall they call on him in whom they have not believed? And how shall they believe in him of whom they have not heard? And how shall they hear without a preacher? And how shall they preach unless they are sent? As it is written, how beautiful are the feet of those who preach the gospel of peace, who bring glad tidings of good things." Is God sovereign enough to reach into the heart of somebody in Africa, change their life, and bring them to faith? Absolutely he is. So why does he send missionaries there? Doesn't that just baffle your mind? He does it because very often God decides to use creatures to accomplish his plan. He does that here with Moses. He reveals himself as one who uses men to accomplish his plan. God ordains both the end and the means to accomplish the end. Why do we have leaders? We have leaders because God uses leaders to lead people. He could do it himself. But instead, he calls people to leadership to do it. So my question is, what is he calling you to do? What is he asking of you? You know, you have certain gifts, certain talents, certain things that he has placed in your life so that you might be able to serve the church, you might be able to serve him. And when we sit back and we say, "Well, God will do it," or "someone else will do it," yes, they could. But God might have chosen you to do it. Also, we see in verse 12 that God reveals himself as one who is personal. One who is personal. And so Moses asks another question. After God says, "I'm going to send you," the natural response of all of us, as it was with Moses, is, "Who am I?" Now, of all people, Moses was the most prepared to be the leader of the people out of Egypt. He had been 40 years studying among the Egyptians, learning how to be a prince, learning how to communicate with the Egyptians, learning about their culture, learning about the people, all the history. He was the most prepared, and yet when God called him to that task, what does he say? "Who am I?" And you know, isn't it interesting when sometimes when God calls you to a certain task, in the back of your mind you think, "Me? I couldn't do that. Why me?" Well, that's what Moses is asking. But listen to what God responds. In verse 12, he says, "So he said, I will certainly be with you." That is a Hebrew idiom. And in the Hebrew, if you were to read it, it really says, being with you, I will be with you. It's a way of redundantly saying something of certainty in Hebrew. And so what he's basically saying is he's saying, look, do not worry, I'm going to be with you. It's not just you going out there by yourself leading the people of Israel out. It's not just like I'm telling you what to do and then not giving you the strength to do it. In fact, later on we'll see that he actually does all the wonders himself. Moses just kind of, you know, throws up a staff once in a while or, you know, hits some. He doesn't really do a whole lot. But it's through his leadership that the people of Israel are raised up. And so God says, I will truly or certainly be with you. The Bible does not teach deism. Deism is a concept or a philosophy or a theology or whatever you want to call it, where God has created the world, he's put certain natural systems in place, and he's put in certain structures and certain laws, and then he sits back and lets things happen. That's the idea of deism. And deism was very popular in the Enlightenment period. And during some period of our founding, now some of our founders were that way, but not all of them. A lot of them were good Bible-believing Christians, but some of them were deists. And the concept was that God has placed all these things into a certain order, and then he steps back and lets us take care of it. Well, that's not what the Bible teaches. The Bible teaches that, yes, he has certain structures in place. He's put certain systems in place. He's put certain pertinent laws around us. But then not only does he say, go and do it, but he says, I will be with you in doing it. So he does not call us to do what he also does not equip us to do. Listen to what it says in Colossians chapter 1, verse 27. To them God willed to make known what are the riches of the glory of this mystery among the Gentiles, which is Christ in you, the hope of glory. He will be present with us. John chapter 15, verse 7. If you abide in me and my words abide in you, you will ask what you desire and it shall be done for you. John 14, 23, Jesus answered and said to them, if anyone loves me, he will keep my word, and my Father will love him and will come into him and make our home with him. Well, that's a pretty personal God. A God that will dwell in us and make his home in us. 1 Corinthians chapter 3, verse 16 says, do you not know that you are the temple of God and that the Spirit of God dwells in you? Galatians chapter 2, verse 20 says, I have been crucified with Christ. It is no longer I who live, but Christ lives in me. And the life which I now live in the flesh, I live by faith in the Son of God who loved me and gave himself for me. Christ in us, the hope of glory. That's a personal God. And it reminds me of the poem called Footprints. Some of you have probably heard this before. It goes like this, written by Mary Stevenson. One night I had a dream. I dreamed I was walking along in the beach with the Lord, and across the sky flashed scenes from my life. For each scene, I noticed two sets of footprints. One belonged to me, and the other to the Lord. When the last scene of my life flashed before me, I looked back at the footprints in the sand, and I noticed that many times along the path of my life, there was only one set of footprints. I also noticed that it happened to be at the very lowest and saddest times in my life. This really bothered me, and I questioned the Lord about it. Lord, you said that once I decided to follow you, you would walk with me all the way. But I have noticed that during the most troublesome times in my life, there is only one set of footprints. I don't understand why in times when I need you most, you should leave me. The Lord replied, my precious, precious child, I love you and I would never leave you. During your times of trial and suffering, when you saw only one set of footprints, it was then that I was carrying you. You see, that's the personal God that we worship. That's the kind of God who doesn't leave his children alone to work out their own situation. It's not a God who commands us to go and lead the people of Israel out and then doesn't give us the strength to do it. He's not the one who calls us to be a Sunday school teacher, or calls us to be a pastor, or calls us to be someone who cleans the church, or someone who works in WMU, whatever. He doesn't call us to these things and then say, but I'm going to step back and let you do it on your own. No, he's a God who is faithful, a God who is personal, a God who works in our life. And then Moses asks another question in verse 13. Then Moses said to the Lord, indeed, when I come to the children of Israel and say to them, the God of our father has sent me to you, and they say to me, what is his name? What shall I say to them? Now, it's interesting to note how he phrases this question. He's not asking who it is that he's talking with. He knows who he's talking with. He's already identified himself as the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, the God of his fathers. He knows he's talking to the God who created the world. He knows all this. So what's he asking? He's asking for some verification of the character of God that will demonstrate to the people of Israel that God is faithful, that God is able to do what he says he's going to do. In other words, he wants some kind of confirmation where he can go to the people and he can say, look, the God of our fathers has brought me to tell you that he is going to deliver you. And this is the promise that he's going to deliver you. It's this kind of God that's going to do it. That's what he's looking for. And so what does God answer him? This is great. Verse 14. And God said to Moses, I am who I am. Therefore tell the people, I am sent you. Now, in order to understand the ramifications of this, we have to understand a little bit about Hebrew. Now, I'm not going to start speaking Hebrew on you, but I do think it's important for us to understand what is being revealed here. The word I am, of course, is the idea of being existing. It is the concept of existing. And the word I am there is in Hebrew spelled out YHWH. It's what we have heard Yahweh before. That's his proper name, Yahweh. And it comes from this idea. And the idea behind his name is that his name is I exist. I am. I have always existed. I am who I am. I will be who I will be. In other words, his very name explains who he is as the pre-existent one. The one who was and is and always will be forever eternal God. That's who God is. And so he is explaining this to Moses. Now, in our culture, we have transliterated this and brought it down into different kinds of transliterations in English terms. And it all started back when the Jews, out of reverence to the name of God, would not pronounce Yahweh. When they came across his name, W-H-Y-H, they would read it as Adonai, meaning Lord, rather than pronouncing his actual name. And so what happened over time is that the Masoretes, who were scribes, they would copy this name and they would put in the vowel letters for Lord, Adonai, in there. And over time, what happened was that then got translated as Jehovah, because the vowel letterings for Adonai and Yahweh got mixed together. And so when you hear people talking about Jehovah, just remember it is a transliteration from German into English, from Hebrew, which is a scribe's transliteration of Adonai and Yahweh. All right, so next time Jehovah's Witness come to your house and say, you know, you got to preach, tell them that, and that will really throw them for a curve, right? So, but the idea behind it, even in our own English translations, we see this concept. In fact, I'm using the New King James here. If you're using the King James, it's probably something similar. I knew the New American Standard. All these usually have the same thing, and that is when you see L, capital O, capital R, capital D, that's Yahweh. When you see L, capital, and then O-R-D in the small, that just means that's another name for God. That's Adonai. That would be like Lord. And so even in our own English translations, we see that they have kept that tradition of not saying the name of Yahweh, not saying his proper name. But that is what his proper name is. It is Yahweh. Now, whether I'm pronouncing exactly how he would pronounce it, I don't know. But that is what is indicated in the scriptures. And so what do we have? We have God revealing himself as the pre-existent one. And so in the very beginning of the scriptures, what do we have? The very first verse of the Bible. In the beginning, God. What beginning? The beginning of everything. The beginning of time. The beginning of history. The beginning of creation. The beginning of everything. God was already there. We see this in John chapter 1. In the beginning was the Word. The beginning of what? The beginning of everything. God existed prior to that. He has always existed, and he always will exist. He is the one who created time. I've used this illustration before, but when we look at a ruler, we can see the beginning and the end of the ruler. That's the way God is. He's outside of time. He can see the beginning of time and the end of time. And so when he says in his word, in the beginning, he saw the beginning of it. Why? Because he's outside of the beginning. He's outside of time. He is the creator of the entire universe. He has always existed. Of course, this carries on into the New Testament with all the I am statements of Jesus. When he says, I am the bread of life. I am the good shepherd. I am the door of the sheep. What is he saying? He is saying, he is identifying himself as that pre-existent God. And then, of course, we get to that great passage when he is talking with the Jews about Abraham and being descendants of Abraham. And he says, before Abraham was, I am. Now, that's grammatically incorrect, but it's theologically correct. Because he has always existed and always will exist. Now, if something has existed before God, that would be God, right? I mean, it makes common sense to think that whatever has existed prior to something else, that's supreme. If I won't make cakes. If Joanna makes a cake, okay, she existed prior to the cake. And so if there is something that existed prior to God, that's God. And so it's only natural for us to think that if God created everything, that's God. Now, we have, of course, in our culture and in our humanistic environment in which we live, this concept of evolution and the Big Bang Theory. And the Big Bang Theory, of course, is the idea that from some singular point of continuity, there was this explosion. And from this explosion, the worlds were sent out and the universe was created from this Big Bang creation. Well, here's something you can talk to those who believe this and ask them, well, what was before the Big Bang? What started all the point of singularity that caused the Big Bang? And they'll say, well, it was a discontinuity within the singular point of continuity, whatever. And they'll come up with something. Well, what caused that? What was before that? And they don't have an answer. They can't go back that far. Why? Because if you do not believe in God, you've got to come up with some magical formula for creating the world. But when you believe God and what he says, he is the pre-existent one. He's the one that brought it all into existence. He is the one who was and is and always will be forever. We can all point to a date in which we started. I was born January 15th, 1970, so 10 months before that time, I was not around. I was not formed. I was not created. I was not. The only thing that I had was that God knew I was going to be born. That's it. We can all point to our existence, but God can't point to his existence. You look at all the mythologies of the world. If you look at the Norwegian mythologies, or you look at the Irish mythologies, or you look at the Greek and Roman mythologies, all their gods were created. They had some, titan that created this thing, and they were all created. But the scriptures say God was not created. He has always existed. And that's the kind of God that we worship, the one who is always pre-existent. Our God who's the one who is self-revelatory and pre-existent. Also, we see in verses 16 through 22 that God reveals himself as the deliverer. He reveals himself as the deliverer. Look with me in verses 16 through 18. He says, "Go and gather the elders of Israel together and say to them, 'The Lord God of our fathers, the God of Abraham and Isaac and of Jacob, appeared to me, saying, I have surely visited you and seen what is done to you in Egypt. And I have said, I will bring you out of the afflictions of Egypt into the land of Canaanites, to the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and Jebusites, to a land flowing with milk and honey.'" Did you catch that? I am the God who will bring you out. Go and tell the people of Israel, the elders, the bearded ones, it says, go and tell them that I am going to bring you out. I am the deliverer. Verse 18. "Then they will heed your voice, and you shall come, and the elders of Israel and the king of Egypt, and you shall say to him, 'The Lord God of the Hebrews has met with us, and now please, let us go 3 days' journey into the wilderness, that we may sacrifice to the Lord our God.'" So he says, look, you go to the elders of Israel, you tell them I'm going to deliver them. They will then go with you. You go before Pharaoh and you tell Pharaoh, I'm going to deliver the people of Egypt. That's easy, right? What does Pharaoh say? Verse 19. "But I am sure that the king of Egypt will not let you go." No, not even by my mighty hand. "So I will stretch out my hand and strike Egypt with all my wonders, which I will do in the midst. And after that, he will let you go." You see, there's nothing that gets in the way of God's deliverance. When God says he's going to deliver, he's going to deliver. Nothing gets in the way. We can be assured of that. We can be assured of his promises that he will bring it to pass. And then verses 21 through 22, "Not only will there be a deliverance," he says, "but there will be a plundering of the people of Egypt." He says, when the time comes for you to go, you're supposed to talk to your neighbors, gather together all of their jewelry. They'll give it to you because they're so afraid. Get all their gold, all their fine silver, everything that you can take out, and you will plunder the Egyptians because they have kept you in slavery for 400 years. That will be your restitution. And so God not only delivers, but he delivers them with goods. It's important to note that the purpose for their deliverance was so that they might go and worship God. You see, God does not save us. God does not deliver us so that we can enjoy life, although we do. God does not deliver us so that we might be able to enter into paradise, although we do. God delivers us so that we might worship him. Our salvation is not about us. The salvation of the people of Israel was not about them. The salvation of the people of Israel, the salvation of us, is about God and worshiping him. This is a major theme in all the scriptures. Ever since the fall of Genesis 3, where he promised one who would smoke the head of the devil. And then he promises deliverance in Genesis and Exodus here. He delivers his people. And the judges, what does he do? He raises up people to deliver his people. And then in the kings, he delivers his people. And then in the prophets, he prophesies a further deliverance that will come in Christ. And then finally, when Christ comes, he demonstrates himself as being the deliverer. The salvation, his very name indicates it so. God is a God who delivers, who saves his people. Now, when I was younger, I used to love the Lone Ranger programs on television. Remember the Lone Ranger programs on television? One of the things I loved about the Lone Ranger television shows, and for some reason, shows today just don't have this. But you always knew the good guys, right? He always rode in our white horse. Now, that was the way, even, Trigger. Remember Trigger? You know, we always knew who the white hat, you know. There was always, Roy Rogers, thank you. I was trying to remember the name. There's always the good guys in those shows. Nowadays, it's kind of like the good guys are like kind of working undercover as bad guys. And the bad guys kind of working undercover as good guys. And it's kind of hard to figure out which one's which, you know. But back in those days, the shows was completely predictable. Here's a Lone Ranger in a heartbeat. Ready? The good guys get captured, or the good guys get in some way in trouble by the bad guys. Then Lone Ranger comes on the scene, and he rescues the good guys. Everybody wants to thank him, and he rides off into the sunset. That's Lone Ranger in a heartbeat, isn't it? Predictable. Every show was just like that. Now, the different good guys might get in trouble by different bad guys. But it was the same show over and over again. It was predictable. And there, you know what? There's one thing predictable with God. Well, there's a lot of things predictable with God. But one thing that we can predict about God, he'll deliver his people. Nothing will get in the way. He will rescue us. If Lone Ranger can rescue the good guys every episode, how much more will God rescue his people when he promises to do so? He hears the cries of his people in bondage. He who promises deliverance will bring it to pass. And so what we have in this passage is God revealing himself. He reveals himself in nature in many ways. We look up into the stars and we see his revelation. We look at the bright shining of the sun and we see his revelation. We see the moon and the reflection of that and we see his revelation. But we also see his revelation specifically in the scriptures. And we see him revealing himself here to Moses as a God who is preexistent, as the one who is unapproachably holy, as the one who uses man to accomplish his purposes, as the one who is a personal God, able to be with us in our times of need, and as the God who delivers. Being able to have confidence in such a God like this should enable us to be able to exercise our faith in such a way that it brings him glory. It should be a comfort to us. I want us to think for a moment. If you were to, and I know some of you may have to stretch to come to this illustration, but I love basketball. And I used to love to play it all the time. Now I don't play it as much as I used to. But we would go to open gyms. And if you've ever been to an open gym, what it is, you kind of go there and there's just a bunch of people waiting around to play. And you kind of form your own teams. And inevitably, if you were not used to going to that group, you would rarely get picked to play on a team because they didn't know how good you were, right? And if you finally got picked on a team, you're looking around, you're wondering, yeah, I'm not so sure this team's going to be that good, you know? And you kind of have some doubts about whether or not you're going to be able to play up to par. Well, I want you to think for a moment. Imagine going to an open gym like that. And you look at the opposing forces and you say, well, there's some good players here. And then Michael Jordan walks in. And Michael Jordan comes over to you and say, hey, I'm going to get in a team together. You want to play on my team? See, now you have some confidence, right? So that's the way it is for us as Christians, only to a far greater extent. No matter what the task is before us, what was delivering Israel out of Egypt a difficult task? You better believe it. You had some people that were used to being slaves. You had some people that were comfortable in their own situation. You had some people that had, for 400 years, experienced nothing but Egypt. And you had a leader who wanted to keep them there. You had all the power and the wealth of Egypt opposed to you. It was a difficult task. But God was on the side of Moses. And when God's on our side, there's no task too difficult. That's what God was trying to communicate in this passage through his revelation to Moses. And it's what is communicated to us today as well. So whatever it is that is before you, whatever task, whatever challenge that has arisen, God is faithful. Let's pray.
And with that, this has been Steve Donahue with the Legacy Podcast, helping you build a multi-generational legacy of abundance. What will you do today to build your legacy?
Country is lost, and it's not without cost, for there's many who struggle every day. And I think that it's time we start crying for our nation and lift our hands and pray. If today you lost your life, what would you leave behind? What would the ones around you see? What happened in the dash between your birth and death? What will you do to change your legacy? Say goodbye. But just like the plant that withers away, we will leave many seeds behind. If today you lost your life, what would you leave behind? What would the ones around you see? What happened in the dash between your birth and death? What will you do to change your legacy? What will you do to change your legacy?